outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of Bavada's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Journey.
But we've made it to December. My goodness, I can't believe it. The year started, it seemed all good, and then things got really dark and nasty and ugly, and now we're coming up on the end of the year. The laughter you hear in the background is my good friend, Gil Michel. Gil, welcome again to the God Journey.
Thank you so much, Wayne. I appreciate being here.
Gil's an old friend. He was on about 3 years ago, but older friend than that. You started, as I recall, listening to the Jake book, or reading the Jake book, while we were still posting it chapter by chapter online.
That is correct. I remember fondly.
And frustratingly, I would think.
Oh, it was so frustrating. It was like it was like on a daily basis for people, those who are on a cliffhanger with a soap opera. We're like, what's going to happen? What's going to happen next? And so, and there were some times, quite honestly, Wayne, in those times, you took some time, a little bit too much time to post those next chapters.
Every time we talk about this, I have horrible feelings about what we did to people, because we were going to do a chapter a month, and it ended up being a chapter every 4 months.
Yep.
And people were hanging on the story. And a lot of people don't even remember it. I mean, I talk to people who don't even know it was first. It was first chapter by chapter online, because no one would publish it. So we thought, well, we'll do it that way. And then we published it, 2005? So, and that's when the God Journey started, was 2005. So you've been in touch with me for a long time, but just in the last
15 years.
Yeah, and we've got a mutual friend that lives in New York, which is where you're from.
Yep, exactly.
But now you live in South Bend, Indiana. Tell us about your life a little bit there.
Yeah, I actually got here about 20 years ago. Came here to work with a ministry called Prayer Summit International. And they were going from city to city, organizing these prayer conferences, prayer summits is what they called it. And so that's how I got here. And then being from New York, lived a little bit in Ghana, West Africa for a little bit. And in that time from Ghana to then South Bend and experiencing and going through a divorce about 12 years ago, all with the backdrop and context of ministry in the background, wasn't really pretty. And since then, I've now been remarried for the past 8 years and new son. So I have a 24-year-old daughter who's in grad school in Chicago, and then a 6-year-old, you know, going through the rigors of first grade here in South Bend. So
yeah. And you're also a CPA, is that right?
Yes. I'm an accountant. And I have my own firm and pastor at church. So I'm both. People go, oh, you're bivocational? I was like, nope. Well, yeah, but I'm full-time in both. So,
yeah, they say there is no part-time ministry. There's no such
thing. There is no time, no part-time. I get calls all kinds of times. But yeah, it's been awesome. You know, our church is really interesting in that we started on Saturday nights. We moved to Sundays. And now with COVID, we're in a weird, interesting place where we've not been meeting for quote-unquote services since March for Sunday services, but we are gathering to pray, and we're doing, our church has morphed into this another thing. And that's been interesting as well in the midst of everything else that's going on. So we feel like it's a good thing. It's actually forced us to get out of the rut of churchiness that we call it. And it's forcing us to actually to evolve, I would say. So that's been interesting. We can probably delve into that a little bit later too. But yeah,
we're here now. Tell me a little bit about that. Tell me what that's morphing looks like.
Yeah. You know, when we were, you know, because of state issues and COVID,
sure,
we were told, you know, hey, it's probably not a good idea to meet. A lot of churches were doing it anyway, like, our rights. We're going to do what we want. God gives us freedom and America. And so, people are like, we're going to meet. We decided we have not met like that since March. Instead, we said, maybe God is doing something and forcing us out of the building so that we can reinvent ourselves in a way that expresses the kingdom in a way that we would not have had COVID not occurred.
Awesome.
Everyone's saying that this is this bad thing. And it is bad. Don't get me wrong. People are dying.
It is.
And it's bad. But perhaps God is using it, like almost like persecution in the book of Acts, to maybe get the gospel to spread in a way that we would not have had this not occurred. So we're going into parks, we're going and we're meeting, and we've changed the way, you know, the spectator sport model where everyone sits in a chair and you get the person in front of you, you get to stare at the back of their head while you get to hear me
preach passionately and worship is so awesome. And if you had asked people in our church, like, how would you describe our church? And our, the name of our church is That Church Downtown. We call it TCD. And if you ask people, like, what would you say about your church? They will say, it's awesome. The music is awesome. We love seeing people and we love Gil. He's a great preacher. They would say that. I don't know about me. And so they would say it's great. However, if you ask me, my wife, after every Sunday, we'd be like, this is exhausting. And this should be more life-giving than it is. And so it's hard to get out of a routine and a rut of doing something when it's going good, when you know it can be great and it could be better. That old book that, you know, the enemy of good, the enemy of great. And so we've been in a place where people are like, you know what? If you're not guys are not going to meet, and if you're fearful and don't have enough faith to come back, and you were like, that's not what it is. And you're like, well, if that's where you are, we're moving on. And so if you look at our actual numbers, we're probably less if you far, quote unquote, if you want to look at quote unquote membership. But man, we feel like we've hit a new vein and a new life of something. I keep describing it as stripping the house back down to its studs and rebuilding in a way that's more life-giving for the people. We're finding that people, there are a lot of people who have, they've craved fellowship. And so we're like, man, that loneliness and people who crave human touch and fellowship and community, we're now trying to reinvent and reshape what that looks like in light of, you know, the current pandemic we're in. It's been difficult, but as of late, it's been a little bit more life-giving for us, my wife and I.
Do you think it'll be that once the vaccine's out, once things kind of quote-unquote go back to normal, do you think you'll go back to normal? Do you think this has changed what this group will be for a while?
No, I don't think we could ever go back to normal. Yeah, I think it's probably going to look more like, I don't even want to say, but it'll probably be closer to like home groups and small fellowships and maybe inconsistent meetings. Maybe we will meet 4 or 5 days in a row, but maybe then we don't meet as a group or what have you for a couple of weeks. And maybe putting a little more focus on maybe getting people to, I try not to use the word evangelism because I don't want that to conjure up images of what that may look like for other people. But, you know, most people might be thinking of open air meetings and preaching in big stadiums and large gatherings. And we may be doing things like that, but I think it's going to look very different. It may look like starting a YouTube channel and influencing in ways, not for us, but maybe other people in our church to reach people with the gospel that and meeting people where they are and influencing people in that way. It may look like a devotional that we do every week, every morning, that's geared specifically to college students. It may look like something, a local gathering with single moms in somebody's home or some public space or in a restaurant. So in a time where we're greatly restricted, we're taking the restrictions off of what church would look like. And
I think that's awesome. I really appreciate hearing that. Just that, and the courage it takes to, you know what, let's see what we can learn in this time and not be, you know, so aware of our rights and we're going to demand the right to meet and all that, but actually say, Jesus, what would you reshape in us? Because I think there is a lot of God's purpose in the pandemic to help us think differently than we thought before. But there's two people. I mean, I see two different trends going on. There's people who hunker down in the old and familiar and, you know, just close their eyes and we're going to hold on to the last vestiges of what we can. And there's people like what you're talking about. They just say, you know, let's lean into different space. Even if you're quarantined and if you're, you know, isolated more, lean into a different space with God. Get to know him differently, better, and let that change your life in ways you can't even conceive yet. I love that. I love you willing to do that.
It's difficult, though.
No doubt about it. You told me before we got started, you're kind of blowing your family up, or at least your household. You're kind of opening the door to some other folks. Tell me about it.
In the words of my mom, she goes, are you running a boarding house? So I talked about the fact that, we have my wife and I, Marquito, we have our son, Christian, who is 6 years old. But then we recently also, we have two new young kiddos,
5 and 7, they're a brother and sister, and we just started fostering back in August. So they're now with us. So we now have a 5, 6, and 7-year-old. Wow. So that just means the refrigerator is always open and our house is never clean. And they're a joy. They've gone through quite a bit in their lives. And so they're with us. So now we went from 3 to 5, 6, 4, 5. And we also have a young man who's living with us who was a member of our church, just kind of walking through him, working with him through life. And he's now living with us as well. 20 years old, kind of management and training and food service and stuff like that. And then we also, another young lady in our church in college, smart as I don't know what, just some family challenges. And she now is also living with us. So she's 18. She just turned 19. So she's also coming home from college and she'll be here tonight with us shortly. The house is growing. And wow. I guess the Lord was like, well, if you won't be traveling for Thanksgiving, we'll send them your way. So
we're recording this just a couple of days before Thanksgiving, even though it won't air into December. So we're all getting ready for a little of that Thanksgiving stuff. So what's your spiritual journey been like through this, Gail? What most excites you about Jesus these days, or what's God breathing under your heart? Anything?
It's been really interesting. It's like, it's like everything has to be talked about in light of COVID almost these days. But
sure.
You know, the first few weeks about it, I thought, oh, God is going to do something. We're going to dig deeper. And I'm like, I wasn't digging deeper. I was finding myself watching more on video and consuming a lot more than I was spending time in prayer. And then it just took a while for Lord kind of to quiet my spirit a bit and really hear him. It's funny. I've been in ministry for over 30 years. And ministry can almost be a bit like a drug. You'll depend on it as a life source rather than Jesus himself. And I didn't realize how much I depended on godly things more than I was really depending on God himself and on Jesus. And so this has been a really good time. Man, my mornings now are not just my just good Devo times. They're really life-giving. I'm really finding that I'm getting to know the Lord in a new way. And so that's been good. The other side of it, though, is in the larger scale, I've been really concerned about the state of the church in light of COVID, in light of mask or not to mask, in light of the political landscape that we're in. It just seems like the church, I don't know a better way to say it, but it's been a little bit disappointing. And I don't want to come off negative because I believe God is doing great things as well. It's just that the larger church, it seems, has been, it's just been probably kind of the way I described it, has been about the things that benefit itself and maybe godly things and things that surround the church rather than Jesus himself. And so I've been really disappointed, honestly, in how I see my brothers and sisters respond, react to the health crisis we're in, to the political discourse that's been going on, to even the racial climate that we've been in, that's sort of been, as of late, kind of pushed back to the back seat in light of everything else. And so it's been a little bit, it's been a lot of disappointment there.
How do you deal with that disappointment? Because I share the same disappointment. I think the evangelical churches, particularly out here in California, been very negative about cooperating with any public health edicts. They've been trying to defend their right to meet, and not all, but many. How do you deal with that disappointment?
I realize that the church is flawed, and I've had to like do a lot of self-talk, the same self-talk I gave to people. Well, I don't come to church because they're a bunch of hypocrites. And then, in recent times, I'm like, yeah, I understand what you mean, but I have to do the same self-talk to myself that I do with those folks who say those things. And that, you look at a Peter and who took out his sword and
sliced the guy's ear off, who had anger issues. They're vying and jockeying for position. They're like the disciples, the people that Jesus left the church with. I'd have been like, are you sure about this? Yeah. But he's done the same thing with us in 2020. Yeah. People who have thoughts on race that are, in my opinion, deeply skewed. Thoughts on what righteousness means for a nation and how the church interacts with the government and et cetera. Like, all that stuff is deeply skewed and flawed. And so I have to look at it the same way, but like, they're still my brother. Like the same family, like we go to family reunions and like, hey, that's your cousin. And we all know when you go to family, at least in my family, there's that element in my family. You're like, we're related, but please don't tell people you know me. And I've kind of felt that way with some members of the church, of the body. And like, man, we don't tell people you know me. Don't tell people you're a Christian. Please don't. And but we're still family. We're still under the blood. And we have to work those things out. And I'm just like Jesus left the church to some very flawed individuals. We're doing the same thing. We're working it out. We're still trying to make it work. So I do a lot of self-talk. I do a lot of seeking to understand. And this is not a shameless plug for Language of Healing, but those type of tools in that book that you and Bob and Arnita wrote, those type of tools have helped me immensely in trying to navigate those kind of conversations and trying to do some self-talk and understand people.
I know I had someone ask me last week, you know, what it seems like, particularly in the light of those that were still trying to believe that the election was stolen from Donald Trump, some of my evangelical friends. And someone said to me, you know, they've got their hope in politics the same way the Pharisees did about Jesus. They want a Jesus that changes the politics to conform, and they're missing the Jesus that transforms their life. And I thought, man, that's an astute observation. I think that's true too. I think we've gotten caught up that Donald Trump, for many, was the guy that was going to rescue the church or protect the church. He posited himself that way.
Yeah.
And that was disappointing because I think particularly on matters like race and COVID, he was not the leader we needed, unfortunately. And I've said that on the podcast before. But the reason I wanted to have you back on, partly, Gil, we met 3 years ago, at least had our first conversation, because we'd had a podcast about some of the racial stuff that I was wakening up to and had a guy on, and you disagreed with the guy that was on, at least it wasn't your experience. And so you wrote me, say, hey, a guy didn't speak for me. And we said, well, good, then come speak for you. So we Brad and I had you on two podcasts in a row, and we'll link those at the bottom. People want to go back and hear those. I think they're incredibly wonderful. You were one of those guys that helped me have a better conversation about race. Arnita came after that. And yet I have been, as I am more aware of how unfair our culture is to people of African-American descent, I find many of my friends who share my skin color just aren't ready for that conversation yet. They're so defensive and so unable, because they always feel attacked, like white privilege is attack on me, attack on my ancestry, attack that we to have an equal America, we've got to diminish white culture. And they go into all that fight or flight mode stuff, you know, instead of just relaxing and going, okay, if it is different, then how is it different? And one of the reasons I wanted to catch up with you, just, man, the last 8 months of what's happened in our culture racially, how have you weathered that? What are you thinking? What are you hopeful? Are you discouraged? I just want to catch up and say, how are we doing on this conversation about race, and what would you like us to do?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I shortly after the George Floyd incident, every time we mention one thing, it's like, before that it was Ahmaud Arbery. And unfortunately, we have to keep going back and back. And it's like, oh man, it's way too many to even list. But every time the subject comes up, I think when it happened with George Floyd, and because of COVID, we were glued to our TVs and our screens, and we had to watch it. You know, a lot of people ask me, hey, what are we going to do? What are we going to do with the church? And I remember certain people like, you got to use your pulpit. You got to use and speak against this injustice and what have you. And I did. I used it on a few occasions to speak about it. And I've been invited on a number of podcasts and prayer calls. We immediately did a prayer gathering in the middle of our downtown where people of all backgrounds showed up and we prayed some real prayers about it and for it and for our country and for the church to know what to do. And during that time, my wife was sort of moderating it, she and another woman. And she's like, right before we started, she goes, "Hey, Gil, I'm going to ask for you to pray for, have you pray for the police officer that had his knee on George Floyd's neck, okay?" And then she started the prayer meeting. I'm like,
"Thanks, woman.
What?" And so later on, I'm like, why would you do that? And I said, "Why would you do that? Because I'm not ready to even pray for him." She goes, "Well, Gil, I knew if anyone could do it, you could." And I'm like, "That's very ambitious in your thinking, but I really was not." And so I remember stuttering through that prayer, but it taught me something, that the posture that we have to take as believers, as an African-American who's a Christian, the posture I need to take. Now, over these past several months, I've been asked to come and speak at a university here locally for their chapel service, a Christian university. And I talked about there's this thing that I know people who work in serving the least of these. They call it compassion fatigue. And I admittedly was going through race fatigue. I'm like, I'm tired of talking about it. I'm tired of being the educator for my white friends about it. I'm like, listen, that's why Google is there. You never heard of Jim Crow? You don't know these things? Like, get on Google. Stop being lazy and do the work. But I also felt like there was an obligation that I had as well, that I didn't have the luxury of kind of being off. And there's some personal responsibility that has to be taken, but I'm going to be honest. I really have been and was really fatigued over these past several months. And I got to a place where I was just like, I don't want to talk about it anymore. I don't see a whole lot of possibility for change. People don't concede power and position easily. Trying to convince white brothers and sisters that they've enjoyed a certain level of quote unquote privilege as a member of this country, and trying that constant fight and trying to convince them of that makes it really difficult to have some conversations. If we can't get to a place where we can actually talk, then we can't talk. And so heard you mention recently about what it means sometimes when you have a conversation with brothers and sisters and they're like, "Well, I didn't know this." It's one thing to say, "I didn't know. Help me to understand." It's another thing to say, that's not happening. There's no white supremacy. That's not happening. Systematic racism doesn't exist. Then we can't talk. And then friends of mine who I considered close, I had never broached the subject of race, but it was for that reason. Like, you know, everything's going well now. If I bring this up, it's going to be a problem. So I won't bring it up. And now I'm bringing it up. And a lot has been revealed in the people I know and the people I call friends. And it's made me reevaluate those friendships. It's made me reevaluate the church, not to not engage like with the church and not, but it's made me realize just how flawed we are. And yeah, that's been some of that disappointment I talked about earlier, but it's going to be a lot to work through. On the other side, there have been people who have stepped up, and I've seen people step up in major ways, and conversations that I'm not able to have with certain people that have been amazing. So I'm not totally discouraged, but I don't know if I see a lot of as much hope. I don't see as much progress in that area that I would like, unfortunately.
Yeah, and what are your thoughts just as the father of a black boy growing up in America? How does this impact you as just a father and his future? And you know, you would hope it wouldn't take George Floyd, because people were trying to wake us up to this reality before George Floyd. I mean, sure. Colin Kaepernick was, our conversation was about that back in the day.
Yeah, I remember that.
And there's just so much dismissiveness. I think people don't want to look at it because it may challenge me to have to change something. And no one likes change who's part of the power elite of the status quo. You want change if you're on the the oppressed side of that.
Right.
If you're on the oppressor side of that, you want to justify the lack of a need for change. And I think even with this discussion, with Black Lives Matter became really rose to the forefront back in March over the George mm-hmm. Floyd thing. And then it became so quickly for many of my white friends a political thing. Well, Black Lives Matter, it's a Marxist organization. They're for socialist yep. policies. And then the discussion, it became so, again, so extreme mm-hmm. that we couldn't. And I always look at my white friends and say, but would you say if you'd grown up black in America, you would have a different life today? And they'll look mm-hmm. at me and go, well, yes, of course I would. I said, that's the point.
That's the point.
Let's not worry about who's Marxist or all that. Because I think the sentiment Black Lives Matter is true. We've got to deal with it. We've got to help it. I'm not necessarily an advocate for Black Lives Matter as an organization.
Right.
I think they've got some great things they're trying to help us understand. And at the same time, they're trying to use it to a political advantage of some kind. But mm-hmm. I just wonder what your disappointment would be. We talked about earlier in the church over political things here. What would you have wanted from your white or want from your white brothers and sisters that you're not getting?
Can we just agree? We don't have to agree on a lot of things, but can we just agree that some wrong things have been done? With this recent election, I was like, this is a ploy to keep President Trump out of office. And I go, okay. Well, if it was such a plot to keep him out, how did he win 4 years ago? I said, do you remember some of the conversations we had when Barack Obama was president? And I said, and you called him a socialist and this, and you made fun of his wife. And you said, all right, think about this. The person you're holding up and the person you were holding down. Like, let's just look on it for face value. Here's a man who's been faithful to his wife, who's raised two beautiful daughters. No scandals, no nothing. And like, you downgraded him. You literally called him everything short of Beelzebub and the devil himself incarnate. And here's a man, like, God forgives all, don't get me wrong, but married three times, as far as we know, infidelity in all three cases. And every time you talk about him, you're like, he's Cyrus. And like, I just don't understand. And then you're like, we need to pray for him. Do we only need to pray for him, or do we need to pray for anyone who's in that seat? And I had a discussion. I had some friends over for dinner. We had some friends over for dinner last week, and they were going on and on about it. And the last bit is when the politics came up. And I just said, you know, back in the day, we used to say, don't trust mechanics, don't trust lawyers, and Lord, don't trust politicians. When did Christians get to the place where we lean so much on who's in office? And they're like, well, the in this election, the country's future is hanging in the balance, and this is more important. I was like, do we not hear that every 4 years? And I'm not saying it's not important. I'm not saying abortion is not important. It's extremely important to me. But at what point do we let's just admit there's some inequities. Let's just admit the way things have happened and the way we view things and the way we view people, that there's not some, that let's just admit there's bias. And like, we have to literally just be honest. I had a conversation with someone. I'm like, how do you feel? Like, you see three black guys walking down the street. It's dark at night. You're by yourself. It's kind of maybe not the best neighborhood. What would you feel? Oh, I don't see color. I'm like, you're lying. Now I know we can't talk. Because let me be honest, I would be fearful. They're like, oh, what? I'm like, yeah. And I'm just saying, let's speak about real bias. You know, when I was here last time, I talked about this Dr. Clark experiment where they showed children black and white dolls. Yeah. And they asked the black and white children, which is the bad doll, which is the good doll? Both black and white were saying the black doll is the bad one. There is an indoctrination. There is a mindset. There is something systematic that is inbred in the fabric of our country that, as it pertains to race, is deeply flawed and messed up. And it affects everybody. So when I said that to the person, like, I would be a little fearful going down the street. If I saw three white guys, I probably wouldn't be as fearful. It's because of the images that are put in front of us. And the person looked at me in shock, like, I'm like, well, I'm mentioning that because no one can proceed without honesty. And the first thing they'll tell you in an AA is, this is my name and this is who I am. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a sex addict. I'm a this. I'm a that. And unless you start there and be honest and say, as a country, as a church, let's take it there. As a church, we are deeply flawed in how we think, in how we operate. If we don't start there, then everything else we're doing is just conjecture and talk. It has to start from a place of honesty, at the very least. Just be honest and say, you know what? Yep, I got some ways of thinking that's not right. We all do. And so repentance and change doesn't happen. Repentance is the biblical word we use. But change, a change of direction, a change of heart, it, as a country, as a church, it doesn't happen until we're at least honest. And I think that's what I feel, and maybe a lot of people that I know feel, is that it's just this sense of not being honest in the conversation.
And not owning up to the inequities that we all know exist.
Sure.
We just want to say it's other factors. It's not race. It's just those people don't work as hard, or they, you know, they came from another country. They have to start from scratch. They have to, there's so many ways to just justify in a way of staying away from the progressive liberal side of, we're going to give a free lunch to everybody on the planet. Mm-hmm. I was talking to a friend this weekend, and he was saying, did you know that the political and religious thinking of a human being is in the same part of the brain, the amygdala, where our fight or flight responses are, where our identity is so linked. That's why, and researchers started going to this, why is it so difficult to, someone has a political belief, you give them a fact in contrary to that political belief, and they will dismiss the fact rather than change the political belief. And that's true right and left. That's not just, you know, for conservatives. And they found out that the religious thing is in that same spot, which is where identity is, which is why when we're confronted with truth, apart from things we think we already know, mm-hmm. we're given to dismiss the new facts we're being given rather than embrace the facts and let it shape and change us. Yeah. And I was hearing this man talk about it. I did some research online about it, just enough to be dangerous. You know, I didn't do extensive. I'm not a brain science guy. But it made me start thinking, well, where's faith then? Where's faith inside the – where's because when you deal with politics and religion, that amygdala lights up. So what lights up when you talk about faith and trust and love? And so I went to everything I'd talk about, where's faith, would always take me back to religion. It would take me back to the amygdala. And then I said, okay, that's not what I want. I want transcendence. I want empathy. I want, that's all in the prefrontal cortex. That's all in a more developed part of the brain. Mm. And what I realized I'm just starting down this journey, but what I began to realize was so much of our identity, whether it's black, white, whether it's Republican, Democrat, whether it's whatever, so much of our identity is in that fight or flight mode. And I have appreciated God over the last 25 years. I don't live my faith anymore in a fight and flight mode. I used to, you know, where everything is an attack on my, anything that attacks what I think is true is a threat to my existence, and I must go to war for it. Mm-hmm. To, you know, this growing affection of the Father and transcendence and knowing the real God in a different part of my brain that responds to affection and to life and to care and to empathy and compassion. And that's what allows me, because I look at the journey I've been on racially, politically in the last 20 years. I mean, there's so much that I see differently now than I did 3 years ago when we last talked.
Yeah.
At least last talked on a podcast. And I just go, why has that had access to my heart? And I think part of it has been that I don't think politics inside my fight or flight mode anymore. I don't. Mm. I'm more concerned about what's true. If we really are, I mean, I know most cops are not racist, but it only takes a few to harm kids, to harm people who don't deserve it. Or it takes fear. Maybe a well-intentioned cop, but he gets into that environment. His biases kick in. This is a more dangerous environment. Sarah and I were stopped on a drug stop earlier this summer. I don't know if you heard that. We were in a RV going to visit my son, and we got pulled over in some sting operation where there a lot of these vans transport drugs. And this is in the middle of all this Black Lives Matter conversation that we're having. And as the cop is coming up to the front of our RV, my first thought is, man, I'm glad we're white. That's my thought. Because this is a different – if I'm brown, if I'm black, this is a very different exchange. And not just from my part, his part. He's going to look, I'm a 65-plus-year-old white guy. You know what? I'm not going to be a threat to him. If I was black, would I be perceived as a threat even if I'm not? And the fact is, too many times, yes. Not by a racist cop, just by seen too much, society. Read too much. Yeah, just the way society has bent. And I even just one of the things about how often you see a mugshot from a black person charged with a crime and how much you see a white person in the community I live in. And that's made me look at every mugshot now and realize there is a difference. Not because then you get the idea, well, more crimes committed by black people. That's not true in this area. But you would think it if you looked at mugshots in the paper and how threatening those mugshots are between the white and the black faces and the poses they catch them in or anger or whatever's there. And this is a conversation we need to have so desperately. And on the hopeful side, I'm finding more and more people willing to lean into that conversation, willing to go, okay, we do have a problem. And yet they're often turned off by the extremes on the left, which is to say, stop being turned off by the extremes. Take a look at what's real. And then ask us, can we do better? And how do we do better? And ask people like you, help us do better. And I don't mean to put the onus, like you said, they get compassionate racism fatigue. I'm just tired of talking. I know Arnita. So many people now want, white people want Arnita to explain race to them and want to explain so many things. And I know she carries a huge load. It's exhausting. Mm-hmm. We need to talk to each other and we need to learn better. And we need to not ask you guys to carry the load of this. We need to all carry the load and find a way to a more generous, compassionate society. We're a long ways from that, I think. I'm hopeful the conversation's going to move forward. I really am. I'm at a place of real hopefulness. I don't know if you are. But like you said earlier, I like that. You got to do the work. Let's do the work. Let's find out what the problem is. Let's find out ways to fix it across political lines, especially from white brothers and sisters in Christ that ought to say, you know, we need to care. We need to realize that you've grown up in a very different world than I grew up in.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. Black people, for the most part, have had a certain maybe set or level of ideals, and some of my white brothers, they'll how you could think that way. Like, I don't really identify as a Democrat or a Republican. Okay, let me just say that up front.
Right.
I've supported friends who've had Republican campaigns. And the same on the other side with Democratic. I ran for city council years back, and I ran on a Democratic ticket. I quickly realized I wasn't Democratic enough for them, or I wasn't maybe as liberal or progressive in their minds or what have you. So it didn't really work out well. But Black Christians are in this weird sort of bubble where to identify with conservative issues is one thing on their Christian side, and then to identify with issues of social justice and humanity and equality, at least the perceived notion of that, we are sort of caught in between these worlds. And I was thinking about this the other day, Wayne, when you talked about the way the brain works. And I've been reading this book, strangely enough, called The Other Side of Church, talked about how we've used the cognitive side for principles and biblical laws. And that, like, but he's talking more in this book about joy. And it took me back to how I grew up. I grew up, coincidentally, in a very Pentecostal church, storefront, Brooklyn church, hand clapping, tongue talking, shouting church.
Yep.
And I remember my mom going to work every day. She took two buses and two trains to get to work. And she'd come home, and we always thought my mom was so hard. I would be too if I had to take two trains and two buses home and to work every day, but she comes home, made dinner, and Sunday, man, when she was in church, when she got to just really be in the presence of the Lord, she was a different person. And I thought about those memories of church and how, like you said, our faith, what part of the brain is being engaged, that joy, that place where historically Black people have been extremely forgiven and accommodating. Like, we don't want to take over. We just want fairness. We just want equity. And I thought about that place and how church, what church was for
at least in the Black community I grew up, how it was for them. And I feel like that's almost kind of a place we need to get back to. That place of the brain needs to be engaged. The place of joy, where our identity goes back to being in Christ so much, not just in name, or I'm a Christian, this is where I stand, and these are my ideals. Yeah. Point one, subset A, like, we're not talking about that. I'm just talking about finding your identity, your joy, your purpose in that. And I feel like everybody needs to get to that place where the labels of where people find their identity and their significance needs to change. And so it brought to mind that kind of thing when you talked about what part of our brain gets engaged when it comes to faith. I feel like for years, that's what the Black church was, or that's what church was for many Black Americans or African Americans here in the country. And I almost feel like that's kind of a place that we need to get back to, but not just people in my community, but everyone does, where that kind of melts away, where our political leanings are a little more fluid based on where we are in Christ and that intimacy, that relationship, that knowledge of Christ, rather than the stamp and the label that's on me. And that's where I'm willing to stake my stake in the ground and fight, and doggone it, I'm going to fight it till the very end. Like, that mentality is what needs to really be shed.
Yeah, that's really good, Gil. We're kind of at the end of our time here, but I think that's the danger, that we've built so much of our religious faith on fear of hell, fear of God, fear, 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 mm-hmm. fear, fear. And then we're all in this fight and flight mode when everybody challenges that, instead of being in a space like you're talking about, where joy allows us to process truth. And if we're going to be followers of Christ, isn't that we're always going to be changing? We should be growth-minded people, which means I'm going to hear things that hopefully change my mind about stuff, because I'm wrong about so much stuff. If God doesn't get to change my mind about things, then I'm stuck where I am. And I think that's where a lot of religious people have been trapped, by fear, not just about racism, but all kinds of things. Instead of, no, I'm going to live in a more joyful space with God. I love that. I love that you said that. And now that will change the way I then process people around me. If I live out of my fears, I'm going to keep growing into the darkness. If I find my way into joy, I'm going to find myself into love and empathy and transcendence and a different way of knowing God and being more constructive in the earth. And I appreciate what you said about being able just to be honest and say, there are inequities. Let's address them. Mm-hmm. Let's address them. And let's find some ways to go forward and acknowledge the pain that your people have suffered at the hands of people that look like me. Mm. It may not have been intentional. I don't know of a lot of people that intentionally grew up trying to make it worse for Blacks. We just took advantage of how good it was for us.
As anyone would, yeah.
And, yeah, and left some people behind that we shouldn't have. Thanks for joining me again.
Thank you, Wayne.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.